Okay, Ronnie Mysterios is coming on. Here's your music for everybody that likes the music. And here's the music.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Radio Mysterioso, if we're lucky, we'll get the sirens in here sometime during the show. Let me plug Adam Gorightly in here. That was coming off my phone, so let's... There, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Speak to me, Earthling. That wasn't a sigh of boredom on my end. I was taking a sip of tea.
During the intro, I heard this on the other end, and I thought, well, I haven't even said anything. How can it be boring already?
So we got some nice black tea we bought back from China several years ago that I rediscovered. Good stuff.
All that tea in China, and you brought back that.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody gave me black tea for Secret Santa and some really good coffee, so they really had me nailed with the tea and the coffee. I should have brought some. I just brought water. I've been heavily drinking the powdered green tea, the matcha, for like a couple of years now. So that's usually what I have around.
You turned me on to some of that stuff. I got some for a while. It's good. It has a good kick to it.
Yeah. It's younger tea leaves and it has a little bit more caffeine in it, I believe. For some reason, I thought the tea had more caffeine than coffee. Apparently, it doesn't. I guess it depends on the tea and or coffee you're drinking. It's Radio Mysterioso. The guest is Adam Gorightly, because a couple weeks ago, I think he called in during a show or something. He said, well, we just come on in a couple weeks. Okay, for the last show of the year in this alternate universe where we all survived.
Maybe we didn't. I was having this conversation with a bartender last night.
That's the person to have it with. Yeah. Oh, did he cut off?
I'm back.
Oh, there you are. I don't know. My Skype said Skype has quit unexpectedly. Thank you. What did the bartender say?
Kind of like, yeah, well, maybe, yeah. And chuckled and poured me a beer.
We were thinking, actually. Go ahead.
Oh, that's the extent of the story. But that kind of just dawned on me the last couple days, and I've been sharing that thought with people as the topic has come up.
Yeah, I don't even know why it comes up. Don Ecker had an end of the world show on Friday night when it was supposed to happen. I was at work, and I usually can't be on, and I called up. Everybody was so talkative that I basically got shoved off the show. So, and he had Tracy Torme on, who's somebody I kind of wanted to have on my show at some point. They become buds now. He's on his show a lot.
Right. I think he has some special segment he does for Don of some sort. Mr. Torme, I guess he has that background as not only the great Mel Torme's son, but he's... what did he produce that Roswell movie and has a background in... maybe he didn't produce the Roswell movie, but he's been involved in...
That was Paul Davids. He produced... Tracy Torme produced and I think co-wrote Fire in the Sky.
Okay, that's right. Yep.
Yeah. So that's what he's famous for. I've met him once. I went over to his house. There's, strangely enough, there's Mel Torme memorabilia all over the house. And he's a really nice, really smart guy. I wanted to have him on the show. Mm-hmm. I left him a copy of the book, but I've never really talked of Project Beta, but I've never really talked. Because apparently he knew Bill Moore fairly well for a time.
Mm.
And there's all these people that knew each other, and you never really find out until somebody just kind of halfway mentions it. Or, you know, he said, oh, yeah, Bill, yeah, I knew him really well. We used to hang out and go to lunch, and, you know, I was trying to start some projects. And I was like, why, really? Bill Moore? Jesus. Bill Moore sent me a email a couple weeks ago.
Ah.
A Merry Christmas email. Just,
okay, still out there, and I guess he's left ufology, but...
yeah, I guess he got sick
of it. He's still alive.
Yeah, they got sick of him or both or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never read Happy Trails to High Weirdness. One, because I never got a copy or never ordered one, and you can start hitting me now. And two, because I've probably read most of what's in there, or have I?
You've probably seen quite a bit of it.
Maybe half. I don't
some
know.
Some of this, well, I'm not sure... couple of my pieces from UFO Magazine Retro UFO 1 and Retro UFO 2, and then my piece on a couple pieces on Conspiracy Conference. A couple years I went to those. So it's a travelogue partly of going to conferences, and as Tim Banal phrased it, peeking behind the velvet ropes at some of the, you know, characters involved at these conferences.
Did you?
Humorous anecdotes and stuff.
Well, now I do want to read it. Did you, is the piece on the Bigfoot hoax news conference in there?
Yes, that's in there as well. That was, where was that published at? I'm forgetting originally. I think,
was
maybe
it
I published that on my blog, but yeah, that also appears in the book.
Yeah, because I didn't go to that fun one. I went to the second one with Jeffrey Gonzalez, which was, I think, frustratingly inconclusive, but at least they were sincere about it. They really thought, as far as I could tell, they really thought a Bigfoot had, like, pressed its face up against his truck.
Oh, yeah, he seems sincere and convinced about it. I'm somewhat dubious, but the imprints on his truck are intriguing.
Yeah.
Who knows what the heck?
Who knows what the heck? I mean, people say it's a bear, it's a moose, it's a whatever the hell. But, you know, whatever. I mean, it's an area.
Yeah.
The coolest thing about that conference, and I should have conference, the news conference, and I should have, do you mind if we just BS?
Not at all.
Okay. The coolest thing I remember about that news conference, and had nothing to do with the people that were sitting there or, you know, the handouts they had or anything. I talked to a guy that's like one of his buds that they go on Bigfoot expeditions with, this big hairy guy that looks like Bigfoot, because, you know, most guys that look for Bigfoot look like Bigfoot eventually. And he started telling me, he said, did you know Bigfoot talks? And I said, what? He says, if you start asking, and I'd heard this from another guy, the guy that ran that museum up in Santa Cruz after we went to the Wilson Memorial. I heard this from
Michael
him.
Rugg.
Yeah, I think I heard this from him too. He said, people don't talk about this because it's not really, it makes it sound, things sound even more insane than they are. He said, Bigfoot will mimic people. And he's,
yeah, I've heard that they have a, from a few people like Joe Fex, he's claimed he's seen these critters and that they have a pretty complex language.
Yeah, and I heard that from him. But the thing was, he said that people, he goes, what do you think you yell at somebody when they're like, messing with you or coming up to your tent or scaring you or whatever? He said Bigfoot will come up and you'll think it's somebody, a friend of yours, and you'll start yelling his name, and Bigfoot will yell the person's name back at you in sort of in your voice. Will mimic you, like, Bob, is that you, Bob? And Bigfoot will go, Bob.
That's hilarious.
And he said the Bigfoot will also, if you start swearing at him, he'll swear back. He said he's heard Bigfoot say, fuck you.
That's great.
That's what I want to hear. That's why I want to go on the Bigfoot hunt. I want to get a recording of Bigfoot swearing at me. Why does nobody have a recording of that? You know, they have the recordings, all the hoots and the screams and the, you know, could be anything. But, you know, either that or just go out there and do it yourself and say, listen what Bigfoot said.
Bigfoot, you know, people only have stuff of Bigfoot that Bigfoot wants them to have.
That's true.
Simple. Same thing with the UFOs, man.
That's
they
true.
Only see what we're ready to see, or maybe, you know, and a lot of people say Bigfoot's psychic, so he's he/she telepathic, so they know when we're gonna take a photo or try to do something like that, record them, and they clam up and disappear. Could be.
Yeah, that's more evidence for my and it's more the UFO thing, but the human interaction with the phenomenon is more than half of what we think the phenomenon is coming out of our brains, and I think that may apply mm-hmm. to Bigfoot too. Not saying we made it up, but there's an interaction there, and we think the interaction is the reality, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. You know, there's enough Bigfoot sightings like UFO sightings that, yeah, something, people are seeing something. It's more than, just making stuff up. Go ahead.
I sort of had that conversation with, now I forgot what I was going to say. Go ahead.
So did I.
Yeah. I remember having this interaction conversation with many people, but specifically... Oh, I know what it was. I went and saw Survival Research last week, if you know who they are.
Yeah, I heard you were going to do that. Sure, yeah, Mark Pauline and those crazy machines they create. They used to have big battles. Did they do any of that?
Yeah, they still do that. They kind of walk around and beat on stuff, and then at the end they destroy each other. That's usually what the show is, and they've been doing that for years. But my friend John Hagenbrenner, one of the Subgenius guys,
mm-hmm.
He said, I'll go, and he brought his daughter, so we all went to the SRL show, but we were there very early, so he said, you still doing that show of yours with the UFO stuff on the podcast? I said, yeah. He goes, what do you think that is, the UFO thing? And I said, he said, do you think there's anything behind that? And I said, yeah, I think there is something behind it, but not in the popular way. He said, well, what do you think? Mm-hmm. And I just told you about that interaction thing, and also that there's just, to me, there's so much evidence that people are interacting with something that isn't human. I don't know. Past that, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's flying saucers mm-hmm. or abductions or whatever. To me, I've got a fairly certain, like above 95% certainty that there's something that's not human interacting with us. And he kind of looked and he kind of said, you know, he said, oh, okay. But I could tell what he was thinking was, I can't bring myself to that point. And that's all I could tell about what he was saying, because he didn't push it past that, because I think he thought he might offend me or something, and I got to talk to him again. Next time I see him, I was like, you can say anything you want, it's not going to bother me. I don't have an emotional, at least I don't think I have an emotional attachment to this.
Well, that point that you talk about, LSD helped me along.
About the being a something that's extra human and not coming from inside our own heads. Is that what you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
In what way?
Oh, I've told the story many times, but it was LSD that put me in that space where I felt I was communicating, interacting with the other, whatever that is that we people perceive to be the UFO phenomena.
Is that one of those things like Walter talks about where you can't really explain it logically to someone and say, because the first thing somebody's going to say is, well, you're on drugs. How do you know?
Yeah, it's the same thing with the LSD experience where people say they felt that they were in the presence of God or that everything was one. You hear that time and again. You hear DMT has its own... experience which people seem to share that you can never capture verbally exactly what we're trying to say here, but you know, the chemical indeed puts us in touch with that other. Maybe it's ourselves, an extension of ourselves, whatever it is. Ghosts,
yeah.
The spirit of the planet, who knows?
The reason I brought...
Go ahead.
I didn't want to imply that Walter does drugs because I don't think he ever has. But his point was, it's one of those things whereby if you experience it, it's, and you just said it here, it's hard to put it into words so somebody else may experience the same thing. They have to be in your, they have to experience for themselves and find that delusion. I guess after they go through it, they can decide whether it's a delusion or not. Mm-hmm. But it's not something where you can say, well, you know, you can't say, well, just trust me, dude. You can't really. You just kind of have to wait for the people that have sort of had the same experience as you had or look into it as deeply as you had to sort of understand on a like a subconscious, nonverbal level what you all are talking about. It's like talking to go ahead.
Oh, it's funny looking back. Sorry to interrupt you. Looking back on that experience, there was
radio
kind of
is
a
all about interruption. You know that. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was a kind of karmic thing because when I was in my this happened when I was in my late teens, but prior to that, when I had this experience seeing the UFOs on LSD, which a friend saw with me too, so he can verify the story, and he has. Over the years, but prior to all of that, I was in high school, and I was in a creative writing class, and I made up an incident about encountering a UFO, and basically presented it as fact. And the teacher, you know, he bought my story, and I remember I was going around reading this to people and cracking up about it. So everybody thought I was a prankster, you know. And then sure enough, that crazy experience happens, and we're going around trying to tell people what we saw, and they thought it was either it's another prank, or he's finally gone over the end of the ledge, you know. And so it seemed like the whatever those forces were that contacted me had a sense of humor as well, and, you know, I've described this many times, some of the UFOs we saw were very, they started out as your classic shapes, but as it progressed, they were just these comical looking thing. One thing, oh, I still remember, it was like a multicolored thing with a propeller on it and kind of something you'd see out of a Dr. Seuss story. Just wild.
I remember reading about that in mm-hmm. something that you wrote for Excluded Middle, I think.
That was actually Crash Collusion.
Oh, was it? Oh, well, see, I get all the magazines what's that called when you make up something in your mind and you think it's a memory conflation or something like that?
Confabulate
it. Yes, I confabulate it quite a bit.
Let me put in a plug now. This story about the UFOs and LSD and my Bigfoot press conference and visiting various conspiracy conferences and UFO conferences, you can read about all this in Happy Trails to High Weirdness, a conspiracy theorist tour guide, available from Fiji Press, but go to Amazon and it's Kindle or the, you know, regular paperback and... can even get these things gift wrapped, I'm told, but we're a little late for Christmas, but gift wrapped it anyway. Blah blah blah.
That's the you're almost the Nick Redfern of conspiracy stuff, because every year or so, or even half a year, you've got a new title out. What was the one before that? Was that it wasn't Thornley, it was a different one, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've had a number of books. The most, let me run them down for you. The first one was 2001, Shadow Over Santa Susana, Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos. Then the Thornley book in 2003, The Prankster and the Conspiracy, the story of Kerry Thornley and how he inspired How He Met Oswald and Inspired the Counterculture. They got all these long titles. Then, let's see, there's a thing called Death Cults that I think came out after that that was kind of excerpts and some from the Manson book plus some other tidbits. Then 2004, I had The Beast of Adam Go Rightly, Collected Rantings.
Oh, yeah, that had that wonderful cover by that artist that you use.
Yeah,
I can't
Ashley
remember his name.
Talbot.
That's
she,
it.
She also did the cover for the first Manson book.
Right.
Talented lady. Then my book, James Shelby Downard's Mystical War, that was like in 2007. Then more recently, 2009, had the Manson book was reissued from Creation Books.
That's right.
Kind of updated edition. Then hooked up with Fiji Press here the last couple of years and working on some projects with them, one of which, the first thing they published by me was a Who's Who of the Manson Family.
Oh, yeah.
And then most recently, Happy Trails to High Weirdness. So that's kind of my catalog of books. And in the next couple of years, there's going to be a mess of things that come out, new books, knock on wood.
And if I kick my own ass enough, something that we thought we'd work on together, and I'm just now finding some of those files. So,
yeah.
And I would like to continue with that, because it seems like the only reason I could keep writing is if you were kind of standing there metaphorically with your arms crossed looking at... Somebody has to be standing there metaphorically or literally with their arms crossed looking at me and tapping their foot, or I'm not going to do anything. I'm no self-starter anymore. And I guess after I get the pilot's license, I have a little bit more time, because usually most of the week I'm either thinking about flying, trying to do it, or studying for it. So that'll be about another month, I think.
There's a rhythm you got to get into when you're writing, you know, also the commitment. When you get to that point, you're far enough into the project where it's like, okay, well,
yeah,
it's
got momentum.
For real now.
Yeah, it's got momentum. So. I always likened it, especially when, you know, a million years ago when I was doing co-publishing that zine, it's like you've got this huge freight train that's full of all this stuff, and you just start pushing, and no matter how hard you push, the thing hardly moves. And after you've been pushing on it for a few months, it moves an inch. And then a little while later, it's moved 2 inches, and then it sort of seems to be moving. And then after you've pushed on it for a few months, the thing is actually moving almost under its own power. It's just the momentum you've got going for it drags you along, and all you have to do is give it little pushes here and there, and by then you're obsessed, so it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's a good way of phrasing it. The big train I'm trying have kind of got... unloaded on me. You were a part of that initially, was back in whenever I did that interview with Robert Anton Wilson and you came along with me. It was like 2000, I think.
Yeah.
I know it was prior to 9/11, because
I don't remember talking about it with him.
It came up, the reason I remember, it was before 9/11, was Miles had that conference planned.
Oh, that's right.
And I had talked to Wilson for Miles to kind of be an intermediary, and Wilson was going to appear at that thing. Then, of course, 9/11, I had my plane tickets purchased, and I was ready to go. And then that ended the conference.
Yeah.
It was going to be... National UFO conference, I guess, there in Austin.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that's why I put it in the time frame. It was pre 9/11, but I think it was 2000. And along with Wilson, this was when I was researching the Thornley book. A guy named Bob Newport showed up, who was friends with Thornley and Greg Hill, the founders of Discordianism.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, and also Bob, Dr. Bob Newport appears in the, he has a page or two in the Principia Discordia, the Bible of Discordianism. So anyway, we kind of all hooked up together there at Wilson's place, and Newport brought along what he called the Discordian Archives. And there was some good stuff in there, you know, just some artifacts from the origins of the Discordian Society, and it was like an arm full of stuff that I he let me take home with me, and I scanned, and I saw there was enough there for potentially a book on the history of Discordianism.
Yeah.
And so he was cool with that. You know, he was thinking at one time of making a website, Discordian Archives, but he got busy doing other things, landscape painting and whatnot. Really cool guy, Bob Newport. But
yeah, I was there when you met him. I think we all had pizza.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Bob Wilson ordered pizza.
Yeah, I was very lucky that you invited me along. There was no reason for me to be along except that you knew I'd pee myself. So.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm glad you came along. I was kind of nervous, you know, meeting somebody like that. So.
Yeah, I'd met him before, and I got to the point where I could call him up, and he wouldn't say, "Who the hell are you?" So it helped, I guess.
Yeah. And so I stayed in contact with Newport over the years, and in 2009, when I was doing that Manson book signing there at, what's the place? La Luz?
Luz de Jesus Gallery. Gallery, yeah.
Yep. I contacted Bob, let him know I was coming down. He said, "Well, why don't you, I asked him, I'm going to be down there and touch bases again about this Discordian Archives book project." And he said, "Are you still cool with it when you're down here? Why don't you drop by and I'll give you all the stuff?" And I didn't know what all this, I thought I'd seen everything. I thought it was just an armload of things. But what it turned out to be was several boxes of all these rare materials, which is like this big, how'd you describe it? A train you're trying to get rolling?
Yeah.
That's basically what was unloaded on me. Great stuff. And so it's resulted in various book projects, which are in different stages of development. One of them is in the book, The Prankster and the Conspiracy. I talked about the whole Garrison investigation and how Kerry Thornley was impacted by that.
Yeah.
How he was actually indicted by Garrison, and Garrison believed that he was one of the notorious Oswald doubles in these books. Thornley had written Idle Warriors, kind of a book about Oswald before anybody knew who the heck Oswald was before the assassination. Also a book that came out after the assassination called Oswald by Kerry Thornley. Anyway, Garrison believed these were books that were used to portray Oswald inaccurately as some commie sympathizer with a happy trigger finger, you know, that Marxism drove him crazy. And so that was what Garrison claimed was kind of Thornley's role, that he was also, you know, working as an Oswald double, setting up Oswald before the fact. And of course, Thornley denied all this stuff. And I get into a bit of that period in The Prankster and the Conspiracy. Now, some of the materials, what these Discordian archives are, the archives of Greg Hill, the founder of Discordianism. And it was one of those deals where all this stuff, according to Newport, was going to get tossed into a dumpster.
Ah!
Yeah, and so Newport rescued it. And so this is all Hill's archives, and he saved everything and filed it. And so there's several boxes of stuff. And one of the sections are the whole Thornley Oswald Kennedy assassination Garrison files. And it just that alone, those materials took up a box or two. So I've been going through all that and putting, you know, working on a book that goes more in depth about Thornley and the Garrison investigation. So coming close to finishing that up, and I want to have that ready for next year, which is the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. I think it'll be a good marketing thing to have that ready. So that's one of the book projects. The thing I came across, and I think I can talk about this now, was going through all this stuff, and I see a huge manuscript there, and it's Robert Anton Wilson, Starseed Signals. What the hell is this?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was an unpublished manuscript. And So I've been working on getting that published. I have a publisher who's these things are they're pretty much rolling on. You'll probably see it in the next year. And I wrote the a foreword and afterword to the book to kind of put the time period in context. So, you know, that's another project that developed out of the boxes of just, you know, it's just a history of that period and a lot of the people that were involved in that scene from the late 60s onward. Thornley and Wilson and Robert Shea and Camden Benares and all these people. And there's tons of letters, too. You know, I have some of the letters where Thornley was starting to crack up under the pressure. You know, he kind of had a breakdown there and thought everybody was conspiring against him, including Robert Anton Wilson.
Yeah.
He thought Wilson was one of his CIA handlers and brainwashers. And I have some of these ranting letters between going forth between Thornley and Wilson. And so it's just a treasure trove of stuff. I don't know what to do with all these letters. That would be perhaps that might be a book project somewhere down the road, but I think it would take a lot of work putting all them into context and explaining to the reader. Some people might get it immediately, you know, but if you're not tuned into this whole scene that was going back on during those days, a lot of people might be lost. So that maybe is a potential project. That one of the project is the Discordian Archives book, where I kind of tell the history and show a bunch of the materials that these guys developed back in the day, including the Principia Discordia. And they were involved in the thing called Operation Mindfuck, where they sent out all these prank letters to using their Discordian names to all these different players like the John Birch Society or Richard Nixon. And so I got a bunch of those letters. So that's an example of some of the stuff that will be in this Discordian Archives book. And we're looking at probably having that available the middle of next year. And these aren't even related to the projects I'm working with Fiji Press on. There's a couple other Discordian projects there that we'll just keep under wraps now. So some amazing stuff. I mean, some of these things. Greg Hill was a master collagist. He put these wonderful collages together, some of which you'll see in the Principia Discordia. And so some of these are like art pieces, and we're kind of struggling with how to preserve them and also be able to present them at showings maybe somewhere down the road. So when you talk about this huge beast that I'm trying to get moving and complete these projects, this is something that, you know, when it's all said and done, probably take 10 years to do it all. And I'm like a couple years into it. Well, more than that, like 4 years into this.
That much stuff.
That many, half a dozen book projects, and, you know, what to do with the materials. Should some of this stuff go in a library somewhere? I know some of it we're talking about having displayed. I'm looking at getting a website going to talk about some of these projects to help promote them, to get the word out there ahead of time, you know.
Yeah,
which I think is necessary, and it's also kind of setting the record straight. There's a lot of misinformation in the world of Discordianism. So I thought this would probably be the best way to lay it out there so people can see where I'm coming from. And when I say that I have certain things, they'll believe me, because I've occasionally posted somewhere and people think I'm full of crap about this, you know?
Yeah, well, even when you bring the stuff out and you show them, you know, have the documentation, they're going to think that you're... The funny thing is that the Discordian thing is supposed to be to break you out of that belief thing. I mean, just like the Wilson did, and, you know, I think Wilson took that from the Discordians, among other things.
Yeah. But
there's people who are so messed up on Discordianism or anything associated with it, the Illuminati thing and all that, that anything that they don't agree with is obviously some attempt to mind control them or, you know, put a spin on something that wasn't to cover something up or whatever. But I guess, well, in that case, you can't make anybody happy. You can't make everybody happy.
Right. Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
But you've been telling me a little bit about this for a couple of years now, and it's a piece of history that I don't know. There's only a certain segment of the population can even appreciate it because most people, if you just tell them what this is, they'll say, "Oh, that sounds cool," or "What the hell is that?" or "What was the point of that?"
Yeah. It's it was quite an influence on a lot of different things in popular culture, and you still see
exactly
little references here and there in movies and TVs and whatnot. Of course, Discordianism was a huge influence on the Illuminatus trilogy by Wilson and Shea. In fact, they dedicated the first book in that series to none other than Cary Thornley and Greg Hill, the founders of Discordianism.
Yeah.
Cary Thornley had for the influence he had on the counterculture, he is probably the least recognized. He was involved in a lot of stuff in the, of course, all these things that went on with Oswald, you know, that was odd to begin with. Then in the mid-60s, he was the editor of a libertarian newsletter, and he was head of the curve on a lot of this stuff. So at that time, it was called The Innovator, and it was the most progressive libertarian newsletter, and he did a good job editing it. And he started this fusion there in L.A. in the mid-60s where he was getting people on the right side of the political spectrum and the left side to come together and discuss things. And he was known for having parties at his place where he'd bring in all these people. He'd have people from, you know, hippies with Minutemen and, you know, just exchanging ideas. So that was the breeding ground he was trying to create. And out of, you know, he was kind of, a lot of people saw him as a right winger at one early on, but he was only right wing as far as individualism went, you know.
Yeah.
And as the 60s went along, he got involved with psychedelics and a free love group, mate sharing bunch, and embraced the 60s counterculture, and he got interested in anarchism, and he kind of fused all of that as well as Zen Buddhism and came up who was it? Gary Snyder of the Beatniks, he came up with the term Zenarchy, but that's where Cary's head was coming from, and he actually wrote a book called Zenarchy, which Illuminate Press published back in the day. So Thornley was always, for a while, a step ahead of these trends going on. And of course, when it comes to conspiracy theories, he was really one of the first people talking about MK Ultra, you know, before it became the popular conspiracy thing to talk about. He believed that he'd been MK Ultra'd back in the day. Of course, all of this as well as the Garrison investigation kind of sent him over the edge, as I said, in the late 70s. But he regrouped over the years and pulled it together and continued on. But yeah, he went through a dark period there, and I have some of the letters. He was just this paranoid schizophrenia, the extreme believing that all kinds of crazy stuff.
Has that ever happened to you?
Oh, a little bit during the period. I told you one time. Time I felt that microwaves were being beamed at me, and you rolled your eyes. And
I did?
Looked at me kind of funny. Uh-huh.
I'm sorry I did that.
No problem.
I thought that's what you needed, maybe. Did I really roll my eyes? I'm sorry I did that.
Well, maybe not, but I was telling somebody about it one time when I was with you. You didn't, like, engage in the conversation. It was like, okay, yeah. Maybe you didn't roll your eyes.
I got the vibe from you.
So, that's crazy talk.
I don't know.
I mean,
man.
That's okay. I wouldn't mind. If, you know, we're friends. We can see how we feel about things. But yeah, during the period, and you said you went through a little paranoid.
I did too. I don't remember anybody making fun of me for it, though. Either that, or I was so insane with it, I wouldn't have noticed if anybody had.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I probably went a little goofy after the UFO encounter. Then, during the period I was writing the Shadow Over Santa Susana, I get into all this the MK Ultra stuff in that book, and I'm not convinced that I was being harassed, but maybe, you know, the mail gets tampered with. Let me point out the incidents.
Please.
It was the same time I was interviewing Ira Einhorn for The Excluded Mental, interview I did with him. And I'm convinced what I saw, that I was emailing him back and forth. That's when Einhorn was still in France. And I'm convinced from what I saw, and it's a little complicated to describe it, but that my email was being monitored. And then I had this thing where I felt I was being beamed by microwaves. That happened like four occasions. Probably mentioned this to you before. I was at home sitting on the couch. We were having dinner. And all of a sudden, my body temperature went up. And my face turned red and was like, holy crap, man, I'm burning up. What's going on here? And my wife looks at me like, man, you're all red. What's going on? And it subsided. Man, that sounded just like what I talk about when they're being beamed by microwaves. So, and this happened again. I was sitting in the same location. It was like dinner time. And the same thing happened. And it went on for like a few minutes. And it started. Somebody could have beamed. There was a shot from the street through the window in the house. Same thing happened in a Mexican restaurant on two occasions. I happened to be sitting in the same place, same seat. In the Mexican restaurant, same experience. So I started getting paranoid, thinking, yeah, they're screwing around with me with, you know, some microwave evil technology. What else happened? And another weird one. That was kind of around the same cluster of years. It was a 2 or 3 year period when we did the Wilson interview.
Mm-hmm.
And you taped that for me. Then you sent the... took you a while, and finally, and it didn't show up. And it didn't show up for like several months, might have been a year. I wrote it off. Then it finally showed up in my box one day, and it was obvious somebody had gone through it, opened it up, did whatever with tape, put it back in there, taped it up, and forwarded it on to me.
You know what's funny is this entire time you've been describing the microwave thing and Wilson and the whale tampering, you keep cutting out.
Oh.
I didn't want to say anything while you were going through it. I got most of it. Except the last part, I think you said it sounded like somebody had, it looked like somebody had tampered with the tape and then just repackaged it and sent it on.
Tampered with the package. I'm not sure that the tape was tampered with, but it was obvious the envelope you'd sent to me had been opened up, resealed, and it was all banged up and damaged. The tape was fine.
You still have it, the tape?
Mm-hmm, I do.
Oh.
The sound quality was real bad.
Sorry.
I don't. It's okay. I was able to get some stuff off it though, and I have another. It's funny. One thing I noticed, hope I've stop cutting out on you.
It's still cutting out a little bit.
Oh, well.
Well, if it gets real bad, we'll switch to the phone.
Okay. Just let me know. With Wilson, so I was exchanging emails with him during that period. One thing I noticed and dawned on me recently, he used the handle of Mark Chan, if you recall. Mark Chan.
Yes,
C-H-A-N.
I remember that. He used that for a while, yeah.
I thought that was kind of odd. Then I just realized recently there was a character in the Illuminatus by the name of Markov Chaney. And so that was kind of a spinoff with that. Markov Chaney was responsible for Operation Mindfuck and all that. So maybe that character in some sense was modeled after Wilson, because I think that's obviously related on himself, Mark Chan,
yeah.
And then the character of Mark Chaney. Just an observation for the Illuminatus heads out there that might mean something to the rest of your audience. You don't care, but they won't care. But during that period, Wilson used to send all his emails. He would CC them to John Poindexter, who at that time was in charge of, this was post 9/11, so he was in charge of that new agency. Office of Information Awareness, if you recall.
The Office of Information Awareness.
And so, and their logo was the eye in the pyramid with a beam shooting out from it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This agency was put together post to 9/11 to do domestic surveillance, and there was a big outcry from the public, and eventually they kind of got rid of the agency or merged it into something else, but it was a big bugaboo back during that time. And John Poindexter, an ex-Bushite Nixon guy,
yeah,
was in charge of that agency. And so Wilson would CC all his messages to him. And I have another interview. I talked to him about that. One of these days I'll post that and put it online, where I was asking him, why are you CCing crap to John Poindexter? And he said, I figure, they're reading my emails anyway, so just to save them some time and maybe eliminate a job and spook job and save the taxpayers some money, I just send them straight to John Poindexter. So I asked him, isn't it odd that seems surreal that the image from Illuminatus is being used by this group? And he says, that's basically what he said. He said, I don't know what the hell's going on. It's like a bunch of surrealists are running things.
Yeah, I mean, it's as if somebody who had read that book and knew, had an inside track on the worst fears of the paranoid fringe, decided to design a logo and create this agency. I mean, it was like something out of Illuminatus, actually.
Yeah. And let me note that there's a handful of people that there was a few people that I interviewed for the Thornley book that had the telltale click on the line, like their phones were tapped. And these were former, people who were involved in the 60s radical politics. I won't name the others, but Wilson was one of those, and we'd always get that telltale click. So I'm sure his phone was tapped. They had been monitoring him for years and years for whatever reason.
Well, it stands to reason they would have been monitoring him. I mean, he's part of and associated with people who did not like the way the American society was going and government was, and he was kind of a minor one, at least as far as the public is concerned, figurehead and voice in that. So yeah, mm-hmm. why not? I mean, you've had stuff with your mail, and I have, and a few people we know have, and it's kind of minor. But I think it does go on. People say, "Oh, you're paranoid." It's like, I don't know why you would have gotten a tape all beat up like a year later. Everything I got from a couple different people, from the cattle mutilation and the guy and Carla Turner, was opened. I don't know what that. What am I supposed to make of that? Every single thing from both of them. That makes no sense.
Yeah.
It's like was either lost in the mail or it got to me all ripped up and then there was like wrapped in this post office thing. So, oh, sorry, it was destroyed by the machines. But the thing is, you can open people's mail without them knowing it.
Yeah, it's like they want you to know.
Yeah.
They want, and I, the same thing happened with me as far as getting overly paranoid. It ain't worth it. You know, if you succumb to that fear, then you can't function. You can't, you know, researching, speaking honestly, you know, about these things.
Yeah. Now you're cutting out again.
Until it. You want to, why don't we take a break and phone me and like play a song and phone me in a couple minutes and I'll get a cup of tea and we'll start over.
Yeah, well, we will start over and or continue and I'll just do the old miking the phone thing like I used to do. All right. So, yeah, I'll talk to you here in a couple minutes.
Okay, great.
You're still cutting out. Okay, see ya. Let's listen to Ham the Space Monkey here, and we'll call Adam Gorightly.
Ladies and gentlemen, here we are at Cape Canaveral to witness the launching of the capsule containing Ham, the little chimpanzee. But first, we'd like to tell you something about him.
They took him from the jungle and they brought him here just to take a ride up through the stratosphere. Well, he's about the smartest little chimpanzee. He imitates and tries to talk like you and me. Of course, all this to him was just a mystery. They told him someday he'd go down in history. Well, he was such an actor, so they called him Ham. He was gonna take the risk instead of man. Now look, you guys, I want 500 bananas for this job, see? Yeah. They put him in a capsule like a rocket ship. He didn't mind at all, he just enjoyed the trip. Sailing through the air with the greatest of ease. He never traveled faster through no jungle trees. To tell the truth, I'm frightened. A real proud American from outer space. He surely is a credit to the monkey race. The moral of the story you can plainly see. Some humans ain't as smart as a chimpanzee.
Ladies and gentlemen, the capsule has now safely returned to Earth. In a moment, we will hear the voice of the first monkey to conquer space. And here he is now. How about a few words, Ham?
Well, really, darling, it's been a most tiring trip. I think I'll go to my room now and rest.
Is this working? There we go. Wow, more monkey songs. It was Ham the Space Monkey by Ray Allen and the Embers. Let's see if we can microphone Mr. Adam. What we were talking about was, I guess, periods of paranoia. I brought this up too, and you probably heard it. Remember that story about Paul Krasner?
Kind of about. He had some weed on him somewhere, and he hid it in a tree, and something like that. And he got to the point like, I'm acting ridiculous here. It's they're gonna make me fear smoking weed, then I'll opt for the weed and screw the paranoia.
Yeah.
But he was getting into some pretty heavy stuff at one period regarding the Manson family and supposed military mind control of the Manson family. And
he was
one of the, well, he was the first person to publish May Brussels articles. in the realist back in the day. So he was knee deep into the conspiracy scene for a while.
Yeah, I asked him what made him decide to stop being paranoid, and he said it got old. I got tired of being scared all the time.
Yeah, it's no fun.
So, oh no, that's right. Because he asked me, he said, what made you get out of this paranoid period? And I said, I got tired of being old. And he says, being scared. He said, it gets old, doesn't it? It gets old quick.
Well, it's no good. And you see this with people who get into conspiracy research. Sometimes, you know, they go down so far down that rabbit hole they can never climb out. It was funny. Cary Thornley he parodied paranoia before he became paranoid himself, you know, which was a kind of another karmic thing that happened with him, you know. A lot of the prank letters they used to send out, you know, they started this whole meme about the Bavarian Illuminati, and in fact I wrote about that in the prankster. I think Wilson and Thornley had a lot with reviving this idea that the Illuminati are behind all the major conspiracies in the world, because what they did was it was around 67, 68. Wilson got interested in the Illuminati, and Thornley was pretty authoritative on the subject too. They're very knowledgeable, and so they put at this time Wilson was the editor of the Playboy Advisor, so they basically created a letter and answer that started this meme that the somebody was writing in asking, he heard about this ancient secret society that is rumored to be behind all the major political assassinations. And so that was the gist of what that letter and answer was about in Playboy form. And then afterwards, as Wilson noted in Cosmic Trigger, his autobiography, this kind of pushed a magic button or started this meme, and suddenly everybody on the left to the right side of the political spectrum were writing about the Illuminati.
Yeah.
And of course, that still evolved into their Illuminatus trilogy, a lot of this stuff. And so Thornley had been looking into and parodying, you know, like the John Birch Society and these people who were throwing around these Illuminati conspiracies back in the day. And soon he began to believe in those things he had parodied earlier. In fact, somewhere here I have this will appear in this Discordian Archives book, if I can pull this up. Where would I find that?
Well, what it sounds like is they sort of made this stuff up based on taking the most, and I think Wilson had said that, taking the most paranoid thoughts you could have and then just running with it.
Yeah. I have here in this in the Discordian Archives book, I'll have it's a piece called The Epistle to the Paranoids. And Thornley wrote this back, I was in the late 60s. One page of chapter one appears in the Principia Discordian. I found some other chapters that nobody's probably seen for a long time or ever, but I'll read this to you. Chapter 1 from the Epistle to the Paranoids. 1. Ye have locked yourselves up in cages of fear, and behold, do ye now complain that ye lack freedom? 2. Ye have cast out your brothers for devils, and now complain ye, lamenting, that ye've been left to fight alone. 3. All chaos was once your kingdom. Verily, held ye dominion over the entire pentaverse, but today ye wax sore afraid in dark corners, nooks, and sinkholes. 4. Oh, how the darknesses do crowd up, one against the other, in ye hearts. What fear ye more, that what ye have rotten? And 5. verily, verily, I say unto you, not all the sinister ministers of the Bavarian Illuminati, working together in multitudes, could so entwine the land with tribulation as have your baseless warnings. That was Kerry Thornley prior to him becoming a conspiracy theorist himself.
And it sounds like he didn't even take his own advice for a while.
No, he did not. it's just interesting. That's kind of the path he took, or how his life evolved.
Yeah, well, he hadn't even gotten there yet, and it's funny because you read that. You hear that, you think of the chronology of it, then somebody who's totally paranoid would think, well, then he finally wised up, right? You know, if the people he's talking to there would suddenly think, well, he's come around to our point of view because he's finally wised up and the scales have fallen from his eyes and he sees the truth now. And it scares, you know, the truth shall make you scared out of your mind, you know, so... So I don't know, you know, there's a fine line between a denial thing and, you know, trying to figure out what's real and what's not and what to do with that information.
Yeah, I concur.
And it sounds, you still have kind of a finger on it or a toe in it or whatever. And I got tired of it because I could never figure out. If there was, you know, the reality to it was so obscured by the people who had done, you know, the people you were talking about, the people that supposedly pull the strings, and then the people who report on the people that pull the strings and whose pockets they're in, and then, you know, all the way down to all these filters to your own personal filter and those of your friends. And you don't know, you know, at a certain point, you know, what's real, what isn't, what are you denying, what is... And it's really hard to make up your mind. And all you're left with is try to be compassionate, I guess.
Yeah, I think one of the things that people who are interested in conspiracy theories, one of the pratfalls or dangers, you know, that I see people falling into, and I fell prey to this early on as you start delving into some of these things, and you start repeating what other people have written as some type of conspiracy theory fact, where just because the person who stated it is somebody you admired, you know, like a Mae Brussels or something like that. Whereas, you know, when you really start looking into some of this stuff, and I'm not picking on Mae Brussels in particular, but when you, like the Garrison investigation, a lot of those things are quoted by Garrison torchbearers as the gospel. The deeper you look into that whole thing, it's just a crazy mess of, at the core of it, you know, there might be some things that he stumbled upon, but there was so much disinformation and misinformation that the deeper you get into it, you know, you get to the point where kind of have to toss the whole baby out with the proverbial bathwater because everything's been so muddied.
Yeah.
You know, by a failed investigation and people who had, you know, it was an agenda, I think, especially in Thornley's case, they made up their mind as to his guilt. And so they started, you start constructing things or making your evidence, trying, you know, to fit something in, whatever, round peg into a square hole that you get a hammer to make it fit.
Yeah.
That's kind of what happened with Thornley, but a lot of that stuff that emerged, you know, Thornley claimed that he, you know, the charge against him was that he had seen Oswald in New Orleans during the period when, you know, Thornley lived there. There was an overlap time where they were both in New Orleans prior to the Kennedy assassination. Of course, Thornley denied this, but and so Garrison started weaving Thornley into the conspiracy, and Thornley remembered things later that he had met people briefly, like Clay Shaw, and Guy Bannister, you know, all these major players. And he thought, you know, it was all coincidence. Later, as he began getting more paranoid, he thought he'd been manipulated, and those weren't chance meetings, and that he was set up. And, you know, if the Garrison investigation didn't push him over the edge, you know, these realizations he started having, like he thought that he had been a guy he had met in New Orleans who he was later he came to believe was E. Howard Hunt, even though this individual used another name. So all of these things started emerging in the early 70s for Kerry, then, you know, which you have enough strange things like all these seeming coincidences all stack up after a while, you know, you start suspecting that indeed you were the victim or part of some crazy conspiracy.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, that sounds like a combination of, well, you just described it, a combination of kind of being in the wrong place at the wrong time or the right place at the right time, and mindset, which is mm-hmm. really all you have control over is mindset.
Yeah.
And to the extent
he didn't heed his own words.
But. Yeah. To the extent that you accept or deny or deal with or rationalize or whatever is how you deal with the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably one of the main things and it's, you know, it's real obvious to most people, but that's one of the main things I learned from reading Wilson and the Principia Discordia, and which I found out about from reading Wilson.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. When we met with Wilson there, as you know, question came up, why are you writing this book? And I was like, well, I want to get to the truth about Kerry Thornley. And Wilson kind of gave me a little jab there, the truth. And I could tell he was like giving me a little
yeah
one of those in like nudges, you know. I thought about that later. Yeah, the word truth is like belief and all these other words where we try to not articulating where I'm going, but you know where I'm going.
What we try to do is to use our language and our belief system for some sort of certainty, because that's what people like.
Yeah. And so none of my books have really, that's kind of the approach I've tried to take, put the information out there, you know, give some of my thoughts about it, but,
right.
And at the end of the day, let the reader decide. You know, I have more respect and trust in my readers will, you know, make up their own minds about these different things I write about, conspiracy theories and whatnot.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned this. I was on the way over here on my iPod. It shuffled to an interview I had, and one of the hosts was saying, whoever the host was saying, well, what we're trying to do here is to clean up the UFO thing and let people know who the people are that are really circumspect and are doing the good work. And my reaction, and I guess I was trying to keep from getting them too angry, because I just said, well, that's fine if you do that, but. And then he said, we've got to teach people how to think critically. And I was thinking, if they can't think critically at this point, looking at all this information, you're not going to teach them anything.
And who appointed you to come down from Mount Olympus and cleanse the unwashed masses?
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, something I take from my friends, you, Wilson, everybody, Nick, a lot of people, it's like... And, you know, ultimately, remember that quote from Wilhelm Reich, I think. It said, there are no experts.
Yeah. The thing is, yeah, this cleaning up ufology or all this type of stuff, when you go down that path, too, you're kind of giving power to those people as well that you think you're going to try to... rid the earth of, you know, you're just, it's just a continuation of this mindless jibber jabber that goes on in the UFO community.
Yeah, and the
which I wrote about that the piece in UFO magazine I sent you called "Ufology's Jersey Shore."
That's right, I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wait just a second. I think somebody's calling in. Do you want them to bust our chops, as you said?
Pardon me?
Do you want somebody to bust our chops, as you say? Oh, now they hung up. Well, I was going to pick up the phone. Well, maybe
scared them off.
Yeah. Scared him off already. If you're listening, you want to call back, go right ahead. Sorry about that. I bet it was Tim Brigham, who I'm going to have on in a couple weeks here. We're just going to BS about stuff. He has a doctorate in psychology, I believe. He is a professor, and he's also been interested in all this stuff for zillions of years. But basically the sort of the counterculture, but more, I guess, parapsychological research. He's also one of Jim Moseley's best friends, or was. And that's one thing I haven't done on the show. We haven't really done a Jim Moseley thing. And then, actually, today Philip Coppens died, if people heard about that.
That's too bad. I didn't know him.
I did not know him at all. I knew of him. I knew people that knew him, and I don't even think I ever had any correspondence with him. But it was a sad thing to hear. I wish I'd met him. I guess he was on Ancient Aliens quite a bit, which is a show I've seen maybe one episode of.
I had a little correspondence. I know he was a pretty knowledgeable fella. He was kind of the source for, you know, this guy, the book on the Stargate.
That's Tim Brigham. Tim, call the studio number again, the 213 mm-hmm. number. Sorry. Go ahead.
But, yeah, that was a shame, man. It came on fast, and poof, he was gone. So, yeah.
And hey, Moseley guy. Go ahead, what?
Oh, yeah, and you mentioned Tim Brigham. He's kept...
Tim, call the studio number.
He's kept, he was one of the people who brought Saucer Snare to the internet, I believe.
Yes, he did. Just a second. Let me tell Tim to call the studio number. Everybody's getting cut off. Tim Banal's calling in.
Oh, excellent. Hello, Mr. Banal.
What's going on? It's not Tim Brigham. It's Tim Banal. I kept hearing you yell at me, but it wasn't me you were yelling at.
Oh, sorry about that.
It's all right. It was very confusing. I've been enjoying the show. I wanted to call up, wish you all, Happy New Year, and tell you I'm enjoying it.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Happy New Year to you, my man.
I hope you are all behaving yourselves out there in California.
We never behave ourselves here. What are you talking about?
Yeah, that's true. So you're not going to clean up ufology in 2013, then?
I don't know how you could do that. It's kind of like... It's kind of like going into a room full of dirt and oil and then trying to clean it up with a brush and push it out the door. And no matter what you do, you just smear it around. I mean, it's not going to work.
I think it'll take all the fun out of it anyway.
I have an answer.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
Proceed.
Both of you who have, I've sent this to both of you guys, this piece I wrote called Ufology's Jersey Shore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
May I read it now? Because a lot of people haven't heard this. And it's,
go for
it's
it.
Like, it's a good
like
one.
A,
yeah.
Yeah,
like
I like
a
it.
Page long. I wrote this for UFO Magazine 2011 sometime. So here we go. There's an alarming trend in ufology nowadays that seems to be pushing the entire field toward complete irrelevancy, namely a brand of chest-pumping hooligans on various sides of ufological issues that incessantly and tediously sling mountains of mud at one another through internet forums, blogs, podcasts, and social media networks. A legion of saber-rattlers who seem more interested in making a name for themselves than actually engaging in any meaningful discourse. And so the signal-to-noise ratio has become a deafening roar that makes the more sober among us want to take a step back and try to clear our heads of all the clamor and clutter. I've termed this new breed Ufology's Jersey Shore, a juvenile gaggle in competition with one another to see who can make the most noise and insult each other the loudest. On and on they go, but at the end of the day, does anyone really care? Does all this braying and bombast help to clean up ufology? Or in reality, simply drag the entire field deeper into a quagmire of mediocrity informed by reality TV. Sadly, with the advent of the internet, ufology has become less about pondering the UFO question, the big UFO questions, than it is about promoting one's own hobby horse, where it's more important to be right than it is to open up one's mind, examine alternate viewpoints, and perhaps learn something and grow. And by God, if someone offers an opinion that's in opposition to yours, then it's time to take up arms against the tyrants and go kick some serious ass by posting adolescent diatribes to internet forums to show what a tough guy you are and how the truth is on your side and how you will scorch the earth and ultimately prevail. Once again, nobody cares. You might as well be arguing about who's the best WWF wrestler or how many angels you can fit on the head of a needle, because the louder the volume gets turned up, the more apt we are to tune it all out, the good with the bad, the alien baby with the bathwater, all down the drain. The intent of all this saber rattling, it seems, is for ufology's Jersey Shore to make a name for themselves, to become a UFO personality without actually having anything meaningful to impart, much like Snooki swapping spit and shaking her ass every opportunity she gets for the simple reason of creating a buzz to keep her name out there. I won't read the whole thing, but let me finish on how we end here. Let's see. In summation, let it be duly noted that I've named no names here. If the shoe fits, wear it, as they say, or better yet, discard that smelly old footwear and try on something more fashionable and less pompous. Evolve.
Yes, I remember this. I remember this piece, and I remember it saying, thinking, God, I wish I'd written that, because it's exactly what I wanted to say.
Probably not enough people read it, or the right people, but
if people,
especially at the hype that there's some nonsense going on around that period in 2011, where it's like, you guys are, it's more of a, just a shouting contest about your own egos and stuff than it has to do. You could be arguing about anything, you know, that had nothing to do with ufology anymore.
Tim, you still there?
I'm still here. I'm listening to Adam's pontifications and enjoying it.
But you've had him on more recently than I have.
Who, Adam? I guess if you call April more recently.
I think it was more recently. Anyway, I think you, Tim, and I have talked about this actually privately too. What the hell was going on with people? Basically, the people that were, it's like the room with a bunch of people in it, and the person that's the most emotionally unstable gets the floor. That's just how it works.
It's like whoever's loudest wins.
Yeah.
And
or at least
really,
gets the attention.
They probably do win because everyone leaves.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, you're right. They do win because most reasonable people say, out of here.
Right.
Oh, yeah. You just get disgusted with it all. And it's like, this ain't worth my time.
Yeah. And it's based on something that most people don't really care that much about. So when they see a bunch of people, it's like, I think I said this to Tim, it's like watching two people arguing about if Batman can beat up Superman or something.
Right, that's what I was thinking too just now. It's like, I can't think of any argument in ufology that I would even get passionate about to argue, you know.
Well, that's silly. Batman wouldn't have a chance against Superman.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, say Batman and Spider-Man then, so.
Okay, that'd be a good one.
Yeah, so it was ill-chosen.
Swinging from buildings and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They could both do that, you know, you'd have this argument, and most people just really wouldn't give a shit. And that's how that's how the UFO thing is, and I don't know what the, you know, I don't think there's a lot of people interested in it right now, and I think a lot of the, what do you, Tim, do you, or either of you, do you know if MUFON is like at an all-time low in membership or anything right now?
I don't know. I don't know anything about that. I know that all I know is that I heard this year's event was disappointing.
Really?
And that was from, well, I can say because he said it on my show. That was from no less a source than Stan Friedman. So if he says that, then
disappointing, you know. In what way? There just nobody was there. Or?
I don't recall specifics of it, but he sounded like it just sort of was thrown together.
Huh.
I think he said he didn't, either they didn't get the town in the area involved enough, or they didn't get the people in ufology involved enough. I didn't quite understand what he was saying exactly there, but
Yeah, I didn't even pay attention this year who was speaking or what they were talking about. The last time I was interested in anything, believe it or not, was when somebody gave a talk, I think at one of the MUFONs, about their investigation of the Serpo thing and the... Oh, no, it wasn't the drone thing. It was a couple of police officers. Remember that drone craze of a couple of years ago?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, they had done an investigation of that, and they came to the MUFON conference, I believe, and reported their findings about it. And they'd found some stuff out. And it wasn't really... I think it was, you know, probably... As far as I remember, it was kind of like 90% BS or 95% BS, and then a few percent, what the hell's going on here? In a way that has nothing to do with extraterrestrial anything, but there was kind of a question on parts of it and how things had been done or how people had seen certain things and all that. It's kind of like the how did people in Voronezh, Russia, see a ship or a robot step out of a ship that had the UMO symbol on it? Makes no sense. Why would that happen? You know, because UMO is a big acknowledged 100% hoax. This thing in Russia, they talked to a bunch of kids and they all independently drew this little symbol. So what the hell is going on there? You know.
Yeah, I think that's kind of missing from a lot of the conferences. It's new research and people who you haven't heard before. I get bored by the scene because the people put on the conferences feel compelled to have this star factor there, you know, but we've heard all these people before. We know them.
They kind of have to, because if they don't, nobody will show up and they'll lose not only their shirt, but their pants and their underwear, too.
Well, yeah, that tells you something about where MUFON's heading, and there's probably not the interest without doing that. You know, probably if you go into the past, and I'd just been involved in the scene for a decade or so, but you had more serious research being presented at those things nowadays. We need to put a certain number of butts in the seats or we're going to lose our asses, so we got to make sure we have the Richard Dolans or Stanton Friedman, or God forbid, you know, Richard Hoagland or one of those guys. Criticism of the Dolans or Friedmans of the world, but you know, that's just what it's evolved to, or you know, until you got to have Project Camelot people or whatever. And so when they do that, it kind of undermines the whole endeavor. You know, if you're trying to present some serious stuff there, then you get some people talking about whatever they'll get. Guy's the time traveler for the government. He's one of the speakers, you know. It's like,
oh yeah, the are we just Obama jump room thing.
Well, that guy.
That's one of my favorites. I to be totally egotistical, last time I spoke at anything public, my speech was getting rid of ufology, and people walked out. I just think, you know, how can
so
we change?
Yeah, decided to go home.
Yeah, a couple people walked out, and other people were like, I had a couple of shouts, and then a whole bunch of incredulous questions at the end, like, you know, what are you saying here? And the basic message is shake everything up, do something completely ridiculous, stupid, or ignore it for a while and see what happens. You know, don't do abduction research. You know, continue to talk to people because they need it, I guess, because a lot of them don't know what's happening to them, and they have to talk to somebody. But screw abduction research. No more books, no more conferences about it. Shut down all the large UFO organizations. And what you were saying, Adam, was about nobody showing up. I think that thing that a couple people have done it now, I think, at least in the paranormal realm, is do online conferences. And you don't have to really worry about it because your cash outlay is almost nothing. And then the stuff will be up, and then people can buy it later or whatever. And it's a lot more people can go. And even if nobody shows up hardly, you haven't really lost too much, except, you know, you have to get all the equipment set up, which is minimal. It's probably a couple hundred bucks.
Yeah, you're talking about the online forum we're involved with?
Yeah, or that one, and then I think there's been one or two others since then, or attempts at it. But I think that's where the future of things lies, because then you don't really have to care how many people listen to you. And if there's a good idea, it'll be sitting there for somebody to discover, as long as it's posted somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't cost anybody anything, and you can charge people a minimum amount, like, you know, $5 or $10 for an entire day, as opposed to getting on a plane, going somewhere, staying in a hotel, doing all that, which is fun, and I love meeting people, and I don't think that should die out. I think there should be a lot more online stuff going on.
Indeed, yeah. I enjoyed taking part in that, and what they call it, the Alternative Universe
Conference, yeah.
And it got some pretty good feedback, but it takes, you know, if you're going to do an endeavor like that, it takes time to build it, and I guess Kevin Smith felt it wasn't worth the effort. You know, he did put a lot of time into it, you know.
Yeah, he put a lot of effort into it, but he's got his own show to do. He's got to make a living, all this other stuff. But I'm talking to a couple people about doing that.
About 70 subscribers, so I thought that was pretty decent, you know.
Yeah, that was pretty good. And it, you know, it's not. And then what Kevin and Walter decided to do was just basically almost evenly split the speaker got most of the money for whatever he drew, and then the person that set it up, and Kevin got some and all that to sort of cover his expenses. But it wasn't something where, unless we had thousands of people listening, nobody's going to make a big profit off it or anything.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what other people's motivations were, but mine was, being involved was just, let's do something instead of whining. Let's try and do something. And I was kind of brought in later, but let's do something that's a little bit different, where you can hear somebody that you wouldn't normally hear too much, and try and present some different ideas. I would like to have, you know, other people on. You know, Micah Hanks is getting out there. I like his thinking. I think he was on Coast to Coast the other night, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. How did that go? Did either of you listen to that?
No, I didn't hear it.
Yeah.
No.
Because he's, you know, all this stuff we've been talking about for quite a long time, all the psychedelics, all the psychic angle of things, you know, new discoveries in science, all this. He's trying to syncretize this stuff and to look at all these things in a different way. And he's doing a good job of it. So people like that, I think, should be heard. And it would be nice if they could be more popular, and maybe things would change. I don't know if they change for the better, or there'd be a solution or anything, but at least it'd be interesting again, you know?
Oh, Greg, you're always trying to make things more interesting.
Yeah, well, it's totally selfish. I would like it to be more interesting so I could be interested again. Now you're both here and silent. Why don't you guys fight or something?
You want us to fight?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Tim Brigham called me before the show here, and when the line opens up, he'll probably call too. But he said that he's planning to, I think, have a wrestling match with somebody from a skeptical organization. Or no, somebody from a believer organization. I said, you know what? That's the perfect way to solve things, actually. It'd be a lot more fun, and it would have the exact same result as if, you know, skeptics and believers argued anyway, and it'd be a lot more fun to watch. I think Tim's still trying to get in on the line here. Would you give up the line so Tim Brigham could get in, Tim?
I was just going to say, I'm going to take off, so.
Okay.
Happy holidays. Happy New Year. Greg, give me a call. We got to do this year in review show.
Yes. Yes, I definitely will. I just saw that today on Facebook, so I'll give you a call.
Yeah. All right. Adam, be well out there, man.
Take care, brother.
I'll take care, buddy. See you later, guys. Happy New Year.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Tim. Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Bye. The celebrities keep calling. Now we're going to wait for Tim Brigham to call in here. I hope he's listening. He said he was going to try one more time before he passed out. It's like, oh, let's let Tim come on. I had a nice talk with him before the show. But, yeah, there was a lot of whining at first about the UFO field, and then there was a lot of yelling and screaming and fighting, as you just mentioned, Adam. And now we're in kind of the, everybody's kind of waiting for something, and I don't know what that's going to be. I have a sneaking suspicion it'll either be one, somebody that has a crazy, stupid idea that starts a craze, or the more likely thing is something happens with a phenomenon that gets everybody interested again. Because last time it was, I think the last time something like that happened was abductions, you know, and that was over 20 years ago. Finally. Sorry, just a second. Let me turn the. It's Tim, right? We're looking.
Howard?
We're looking for Tim Brigham, and he's on
that's
the line.
Me, that's me. I can vouch for that. That's me. How are you guys doing? Is Mr. Adams still with us?
Hey, yes. Great. Is this Tim?
Yes, it is.
This
I can
the
hear you from. It's almost like I'm channeling or remote viewing you, but I can't hear you. How are you, Mr. Bill Wrightly?
I am excellent, sir. And how are you doing?
I am good. I just realized, though, for me, in Atlanta, they don't sell a Vita brand beer. It's purely a, you know, lower southeastern thing. So I'm driving back from the store and the end of the bus. I have no idea what you guys have been talking about. But other than that, yeah, I am well.
I know what I mentioned your wrestling match, and that was going to be with who? Or did you not want to publicize that?
Which one? The Evita run?
I think it's the Believer versus Skeptic wrestling match or something like that you mentioned before the show.
Oh gosh, yeah. I'm vaguely hearing you, Greg. So the Believer Skeptic Bash. Oh gosh, are you saying picking sides? Is that where we're at?
No, I wanted to know if there's one, if you could talk about it, and two, what you're planning to do here, even if it's just an idea at the moment.
You mean in regards to which plan? So I know specifically
the Believer Skeptic wrestling match.
My good so far the Bolton editor, better organized than I am, at least David Metcalf, had suggested on Twitter that Richard Wiseman has, you know Darren Brown, by the way, right? The non-NLP guru master of magic in England.
I've heard his name.
You know, it's 1 o'clock here in Atlanta, so you got to give me a little leeway. Richard Wiseman and Darren Brown, you know, are good buddies. Richard Wiseman, even when Daryl Bim came out with his revised version of psychic abilities might be real. Richard Wiseman, of course, pissed all over it. Can we say that on?
You can say whatever you want.
Pissed. Yeah, we can say pissed.
Yes.
On Richard Wiseman, you know, pissed on the methodology. There weren't really that many problems. So the point being, the only way this is going to be solved, because I made the comment that although Richard Wiseman trumps me academically, I could probably wrestle him while bathed in hallucinogens. as we would refer to them in the studies. But I think, you know, David made a poster. I think if we could Darren Brown and Richard Wiseman. Darren Brown is, he doesn't like Americans. I don't know. He doesn't want to do the interview. He's waiting for his American tour. But that's my plan. My immediate plan is to wrestle Richard Wiseman for the future of parapsychology. The whole slog.
Because
are we actually recording? Are we on the?
Yes, radio? We are on the air and recording.
Oh God! Oh dear! Oh man! So, yeah.
You said you wanted to call into the show.
On record now.
Yeah, you wanted to call into the show.
My career. Oh geez, here comes the police really quickly too. I didn't even do anything. That's the funny thing, except for maybe it's the Richard Wiseman thing.
Thought crime.
No, you know. It's Daryl Bim, a prominent, and this is going to quickly get boring if I talk academic, but Daryl Bim, who, you know, I show in my psychology classes from his ladies' videos about how psychics, you know, cold read, and then he comes out with this thing, and he's on Comedy Central on the freaking Daily Show, excuse me here, that you know, well, there's some slight effect, and by the way, the effect only seems to show up in the lab when you use salient things like pornography.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's a non-porn version you can actually download and try, you know, and a porn version you can download and run at home, you know, whatever you want to do with it, all right? But there's, you know, the effect size is fairly small, but the point being, there did seem to be some measurable almost, like, the thing being that people responded with higher heart rates and higher before they knew that an image of pornography, for example, would be shown to them.
Yeah, presentiment
it's not
experiment.
A huge effect size, but with enough people, there's something weird enough to bother, you know, being the point.
Yeah.
And I think I just, you know, I think I just shot my thesis right at you, and that was the end of it, I guess. I don't know. So from there, going back, you were saying, you know, what to do with ufology. And I think, as Uncle Jim would say, even if they discovered spacemen, ufologists would be forgotten. Whatever it is we're looking at, I'm sorry, Uncle Stan, spaceships and nuclear-driven engines aren't going to be the answer, and it's more subtle. I think as all three of us would agree, if I can for a moment stop talking to see if I can hear three of you,
I think Adam concurs with that one. We've talked about it before.
I do. I'm having a little bit of problem making out what you're saying there, Tim, but I had a question for you. Are there any plans to put together a best of Saucer Smear?
No. I felt my duty was completed upon sending out the last issue electronically. Jim had printed one last issue that was unfortunately, for whatever reason, unable to have been mailed. So, you know, with some help, I put that out on the internet for anybody for free. But I wouldn't. I think Jim, you know, even though Jim wanted Smear in some sense to live on, I think he had eventually recognized that no one could do what he does and couldn't pretend to. So, you know, I guess the answer to that is no. But, I am now retired as contributing editor of Smear, put it that way.
So it's not going to continue. So it's not going to continue. I was under the impression that there was a succession of power actually in place, but I guess not.
Well, the Supreme Commander could always send messages. As far as I know, though, Chris Roth had at one point discussed taking it on, you know, with some serious intent. I think it was Chris Roth, and Jim had okayed that. And at some point, Jim, you know, said, you know, or acknowledged that he was what it was about. You know, the soft
yeah.
Smear was Jim Mosley.
Right.
So,
no, you can't really continue it. I mean, it's actually almost a relief to me that I hear that, because you're exactly right. If it's not Jim doing it, it's not Saucerman. It's something else.
Oh, yeah. It was his voice that carried it.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if there's any thoughts by anyone of doing a best of Saucer Smear, going back through all the issues over the years and pulling out some of the best stuff and putting that together for a book.
Yeah. I think Greg and I were at least talking about receiving correspondence. Gosh, we've got both of us, I'm sure, and me especially, have so much stuff from Jim that's classic. And, you know, there are electronic right distribution things I don't know the legalities of. And, as a contributing editor, I wasn't made privy to whatever, you know, pack of cigarettes Jim got for that deal. But, yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't know who owns the,
It's Tim Crawford from UFO TV. Tim Crawford from UFO TV owns the electronic rights, and he's a reasonable guy. He seems pretty nice. I know him. Maybe I should talk to him.
Yeah, I mean, it would definitely. I mean, just some of the we found that photo, or someone found that photo of Jim in like '61. What given the finger, you know? And it was like the classic. It's just a classic Jim. I don't know. You'd have to see it. Of course, it's on my. On my website, which is not prepared yet.
I have seen that picture.
All
I think
websites are, but you know,
didn't he publish it in Saucer Smear once? Like, I think maybe next to last issue, he published a picture of him with his finger up.
Did he republish that? Okay.
I think he did.
Sent it to me. Said it was from the '61 issue. So maybe he reused it or something. But
I think so. I've got two pictures of him I really like. One with the Groucho glasses on, which I got him to pose for.
All right.
And the other one was him partying with two girls in Roswell in 1995.
And Jim, God bless him, man. I met him. I was 13. He was 80. Or yeah, he was 60. I'm sorry. He was 60. And I never thought a man would live much longer. You know, God bless him. He went on the way he went on, and then no one can ever take that from him.
Right.
So, those are my only thoughts.
He never embraced the internet in any measure, did he?
Oh no, and I've actually found myself using a Jim Moseley term now: robots. Robots, because he called everything a robot. The answering machine was a robot.
Yeah,
you know, the robot picks up and says you're not there. You know, but you know, now I find spam bots. You know, and I have a little reply like, if you're a robot, don't email. So, geez, he probably had a Skynet dream or something. I don't know, but he never did. He was totally fine with that. I remember when I first got email and I had a 200 meg hard drive computer. Wow. I said, Jim, we can get you one of these boxes where you just hook it into the TV. And he said, what the hell? You know, so now I'm like, instead of just sending a stamp, I can't. The answer, as you've guessed, he had no desire whatsoever, and maybe for good reason. I don't know. Maybe not. It's, you know.
Whatever. Well, he had his way of doing things, and he'd been doing it that way for so long.
Oh, yeah, with total typewriter all the way till the end, lick the stamp, you know, which is classic. God, I mean, I did a zine in the early 90s for a couple of years, and, you know, just amazing to me to think that someone did that, you know, the longest running in the known universe, right? And then, you know, as far as we know, at least, this is the longest running thing about flying, you know, quote, flying saucers in the known universe.
Yeah, and all things like that have to come to an end. I don't know if I'll ever write anything. It seems too late for me to write anything about Jim. What I told Tim was that I have something like 30 or 40 letters he wrote to me. I saved every single one of them. And some of them were just little note cards. In fact, most of them were just little note cards saying, thanks for writing into Samir. You know, just between you and me, so-and-so is a crazy idiot. You know, stuff like
that. To the degree that I would think he would want it to be, at least to be, someone had mentioned the Barker collection at the West Virginia, I guess, museum or library where the Mothman stuff is, that maybe they'd have. But you know, I don't know, man. You know, I was glad enough people came out and said so many nice things about Jim that there was like, you know, Warren Coleman's got this piece written in like 15 seconds. You know, it's like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that just made me feel good enough to say, hey, man, like, Jim had a great enough impact on me that I can't really summarize it. And someday, you know, maybe if I reach Jacques Vallée level and you read my journals or something for some odd reason, you know, maybe. But there's really nothing that can summarize Jim, you know. Other than that time he had the aerosol can and was just spraying. He would carry the aerosol can and the marijuana on the plane back in the day, right? You know, next to the, you know, 2001, the National UFO Convention that never happened, of course, ended those days, but Jim maniacally spraying a can of Febreze or whatever it was in the room because he was convinced that someone in the hallway was going to smell. But we had good times, you know, and God bless him. So that's all. I just wanted to chime in and say hello and enjoy. Have been listening.
Well, thanks, Tim. Two weeks from tonight, we're going to have you on anyway.
Yeah, next,
So
two weeks from now, right?
Whatever 2 weeks from now is, I don't know what the date is, but two Sundays from now, Tim's going to be on. We're going to talk about all this, go into depth. Probably maybe that'll be my Jim Moseley memorial, and some of his research and some of the stuff we talked about today, like Persinger's God Helmet and stuff like that. We'll get into that in a couple of weeks.
Oh yes, we will. We hope indeed.
Yeah.
Well, it's
all right, my friend. You got to take care, and
okay.
Good luck with
you. Best wishes,
and I bid you good night.
All right, thanks, Tim. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Right. Well, that was nice hearing from Tim Brigham. You didn't mind, right? Right, Adam. Sorry about that.
Oh, not at all. I couldn't. He was kind of garbled on my end, that's why I didn't chirp up.
Oh, okay.
Much.
Well, you'll have to hear the recording of the show when I post it then.
You know, it's a overused phrase, but you talk about the end of an era, and that's definitely an end of an era with the passing of Moseley, for sure.
Yeah, it happened when I was out of the country, and I thought, oh, I'm going to write something about it when I get back, and I was a lazy shit, and I didn't do it, and Jim's probably up there alternately laughing and shaking his fist, if he cares enough to even think about me. But I would still like to write something about Jim, and maybe actually talking about him next week with in a couple weeks here with Tim will be ease my conscience somewhat. And maybe some stuff will come out. I never knew that Jim was running around smoking pot and spraying Febreze around to make sure nobody knew he was smoking pot. That's great.
Oh, I didn't. Wasn't sure what Tim was talking about there. Okay.
Yeah, he went up like another 100 points in my estimation. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So you know he's just, to me, he was just amazingly, what's the word, non-dogmatic and benignly tolerant of dogmatic people and benignly intolerant of dogmatic assholes.
He actually I sent him back in the zine days, I put together a little one-shot zine, UFOs, LSD, and Me.
Yes.
That got later West Nations kind of took parts of that and ran it in Crash Collusion. Anyway, I sent it to Mosley. You know, back in the day, the idea was that's how you got free zines from other people you were trading.
Yeah,
he actually
trading zines.
Read it and gave me a positive review in Saucer Smear.
We have
which I was proud of.
Yeah. Well, you should have been. I mean, to get noticed by Mosley the first time I got a letter back from him after writing to Saucer Smear, I was starstruck, and I still am. I mean, even after he's gone.
Well, he knew everybody. That's what that venture was about for him. You know, was interacting with the community, UFO, whatever community it was, and so. He was pretty good, as far as I could tell, about people sent him a letter, he'd respond to them.
Yeah.
Either tell them they're full of shit or something. he was carrying on that dialogue and Saucer Smear all this year. Yeah, and as far as keeping it going, that wouldn't make a lot of sense because it was him and his voice and... When you read a Saucer Smear, it's like reading Hunter S. Thompson or whoever. He had a well-defined voice as a writer, so you knew it was Mosley when you was reading Mosley.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the first thing I thought of when I wrote something about him on Facebook after I heard he died. I said he was the Hunter Thompson of ufology to me. We've got 2 minutes left. Who do you want to insult in the last 2 minutes?
No one to insult. I have no beef with anybody.
Not right now. Wait till the Discordian book comes out. Then you'll have all kinds of beefs with people. Or at least they will with you.
I think there's going to be some... I'm going to get some criticism about the Thornley Kennedy assassination book.
Yeah.
But you can't... You're going to offend somebody in that community. You talk about ufology, it's the Kennedy research crowd. It's the same thing, but only ramped up a few
right.
levels. And so, yeah, I'm going to offend people there, but I've just tried to tell this story as honestly and, as I can. Where it led me when I started looking into all the materials. And it is, from Cary Thornley's perspective, because he was living through all that. So, yeah, that book, I'll get some people ticked off at me about that. But it comes with the territory.
Of course. I will talk to you soon. I'm going to play Ambrose Part 5 for you as an outro.
Do you want to lead up to why you're playing that?
No, not really. We listened to it recently on a trip.
Well, we were walking through the canyon there, and this was seeing the petroglyphs, and we
Ambrose.
we get to a certain spot. spot, and I think I was telling Sigrid that. She was, how should I climb up there? And I just, that recording came into my head, and I started saying, just keep walking.
So we kept walking down the creek bed. Well, thanks so much, Adam Gorightly, for being on the show and putting up with all the the technical problems. And I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care.
Ambrose Part 5.
Bye.
See ya.
Ambrose, it's very dark in here. Ambrose, where are you? Oh, Ambrose, hold my hand. Ambrose, something's vibrating. The walls are shaking. Ambrose, we can't go on like this. Why can't we sit in the park like other boys and girls? Why do we have to walk in the subway tunnel?
Just keep walking.
Ambrose, when you grow up, why don't you be a doctor? You don't want to be a doctor? You want to be a disc jockey? Oh, Ambrose, you can't spend the rest of your life avoiding responsibilities. Ambrose, how many times have you been in love? Can't you ever be serious?
Just keep walking.
Ambrose, if I gave you my picture, would you carry it in your wallet? Well, if I gave you a wallet, would you? I'll put some money in it. What do you mean, how much? Honest, Ambrose, it's not that I didn't want to have the party at my house. I couldn't. My mommy wouldn't let me. She's ashamed. We haven't got a colored telephone. Ambrose, what was that? Oh, Ambrose, I've asked you a million times. Why do we have to walk in a subway tunnel?
Just keep walking.
Ambrose, maybe you'd like me better if I peroxide my hair like Eloise. 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 You know Eloise. Your mother. You wouldn't like me peroxided.
Just keep walking.
Ambrose. Ambrose, just think.